Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, rent-regulated tenants, you can breathe a sigh of relief. Landlords, it's back to the drawing board for how to convince government that the rent is too damn low. The U.S. Supreme Court has announced that it will not hear a constitutional challenge to the New York State rent laws. We will talk about how it even got that far and the current state of New York's persistent housing shortage and the eternal war between the tenant and landlord lobbies over control and stabilization. With me now is Andrew Shearer, professor of planning law at Columbia University, and he kind of wrote the book on New York State rent laws. Sorry, what's the book title?
It's a residential landlord-tenant law in New York.
Okay, and that's basically a book for law schools, right?
It's more of a treatise for practitioners in the field, so it's rent regulation and all other aspects of housing law.
And by way of full disclosure, you're a supporter of the rent control and rent stabilization laws?
I believe that it's sound public policy. Yes, I support the rent regulation.
Do you live in a rent stabilized apartment?
I do not.
So the appeal?
I have, but I don't at this moment.
Okay, so the appeal to the Supreme Court came from a landlord who owns on the Upper West Side, who says his rights were being violated under the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. People casually think, oh, taking the Fifth. You
right.
can't testify against yourself. What part of the Fifth Amendment was he talking
this
about?
He's brought the case under the Takings Clause, which says that the government shall not take property without just compensation. So, and the argument that's made against regulation of all forms is that when government regulates, if the regulation goes too far, it's the functional equivalent of actually literally taking the property. Use of eminent domain, you would have to be given compensation for the taking of the property. And that argument has been made over the years to challenge a whole variety of forms of regulation of the use of property.
And he hung his case partly on the high income of one of his rent-regulated tenants and the fact that they have, I think it was a vacation home in the Hamptons.
Right.
So is that just a political appeal, or was there something about the income of the tenant that was supposed to affect the argument constitutionally?
Right. No, the income of the tenant really should have nothing to do with the constitutional argument. The argument goes to whether or not this is a legitimate form for government to deal with a important public policy issue, the policy having to do with the ability of people to afford to pay the rents. And the rent regulation, for better or worse, has never been geared to the income of the particular individual who's living in the rent-regulated unit. It's been really it's been geared to affecting the market so that rents are, in general, not raised in exorbitant ways. And can I point out a few statistics that I think, haven't really made it into the media as prominently as they should. Over 50% of the tenants living in rent-regulated units are what's called rent burden. They're paying over 30% of their household income for rent. The Furman Institute at NYU pulled together a number of these statistics, and I think they're quite striking. The other is that the average household income of a tenant in a rent-stabilized unit, and we're talking about 1 million households in New York City here, is $36,000 a year. So whatever the tenants in the Harmon situation are, they're really outliers. Only 4% of the tenants in rent-stabilized units earn over $150,000 a year, and 240,000 tenants in tenant households in rent-stabilized apartments earn less than $15,000 a year. So the program, for better or worse, has never been geared to the income of the particular tenant in the household. It's been dealing with market forces and allowing rent increases on an annual basis based on the status of the market.
And the income of the tenant is taken under account in the changes in the law that were imposed in the 1990s. I think if you make over $175,000 a year and live in an apartment that can charge X amount of rent, then you get destabilized anyway. But so I get your point.
Actually, can I just make a point about that? So you're absolutely right about that, that the law was changed in 93 to actually – so what I somewhat misspoke before, because the rent regulation law the rent stabilization law actually does take into account household income, but only at the upper end. So you can be deprived of your rent stabilized status if you earn over a certain threshold income per year. But frankly, if you're earning if you're one of those 240,000 households earning less than $15,000 a year and you're paying 75% of your household income for rent, the system doesn't provide any particular benefit for you based on your personal situation. So even though it started out as a market-based system, it's only accommodated to the people at the high end of the income spectrum, and it's made no accommodations to people at the low end.
I don't know if anybody wants to call in. Landlords, tenants, we could have for the next 25 years the argument about the rent laws in New York City. The right. news today is that the Supreme Court has refused to hear a constitutional challenge to them, so the rent laws will stand. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. My guest is Andrew Shearer, planning law professor at Columbia University. And you're talking about how most of the people helped by these laws are pretty low-income people.
Right.
Landlords would argue that that's mostly irrelevant because this is almost all about the high-rent districts of Manhattan and inner Brooklyn, like the Upper West Side, where the plaintiff landlord owns. They say the stabilized rents in most outer borough neighborhoods are actually about what the market would bear anyway when you're going out to Bensonhurst and, you know, Flushing and wherever. Is that right, do you think?
No, it's not right. I mean, it's true that in Manhattan, where rents are much higher than elsewhere in the city, the benefit that a tenant gets from being rent stabilized is more pronounced than it is in the other boroughs. But in fact, the tenants are get a benefit from rent stabilization. Unfortunately, for poor tenants, it's not a sufficient benefit, but they do get a benefit from being in rent stabilized housing. And the market rent units everywhere in the city are higher than they are than the rents in rent stabilized units. On average, citywide, it's $300 a month. This is, again, from the Furman Center's data. In Manhattan, the difference is about $1,300 a month. And in the Bronx, it's a couple of hundred dollars. So there's a benefit everywhere.
And the landlords and free marketers in general make a very standard economic argument against the rent laws. Price controls create shortages. So if these laws exist in the first place because there's a housing shortage in New York which pushes up the market price, they would say if suppliers, in this case developers, don't see enough profit in making something, they won't produce it. So there is less housing overall, which creates a shortage of supply
right.
that pushes up the price for everyone not lucky enough to have a controlled
right.
apartment, not to mention that there are a million apartments off the market in rent stabilization or however many apartments.
Well, they're not exactly off the market. I mean, they become available when people move out. And unless the landlord actually deregulates them by raising the rent, they can stay.
But they're outside of market rates.
Right.
So that those apartments that people can easily get at market rates get pushed up even more.
Right.
Do they have at least somewhat of a valid argument in your opinion?
No. No. And the reason that they don't, well, is that first, this has been a necessary measure for many years in New York because everybody comes to New York. So the market is kind of unique in New York and the pressures on the market are unique. But the other more important reason is that there has not been a rent-regulated unit constructed in New York since 1974. All new construction since 1974 is not rent-regulated except for when the landlord voluntarily chooses to put the unit under rent regulation in order to get tax benefits or other benefits from government. So the argument that it's had a dampening effect on housing construction is just, you know, it makes no sense. And in fact, if you look at housing construction in New York City, it follows the same market trends that housing construction it follows elsewhere. So during the boom years, we had an amazing amount of growth and construction of housing in New York, none of it rent regulated except when the landlords chose to seek a government benefit.
Let's take a phone call from a landlord. Marvin in Bridgehampton, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Yes, good morning. It's interesting. The subject is fraught with good points on both sides of the table. I'd like to ask some advice from your guest. I happen to be a commercial landlord for office buildings. However, in the course of my relationship with friends of mine, I bought a group of occupied apartments as they were converted over to co-ops in the hope, and this is going to be ammunition for your guests, in the hope that at some point in time I would get them back. I would either get a higher rent or I would get appreciated value of the apartment as an asset. In the intervening years, most of these tenants who are regulated tenants still stay in occupancy. Apartments, and I'll just give you one example, apartments that I receive $800 or $900 a month in rent have an actual cost of $1,600 a month in rent, 40% of which is made up of New York City taxes. Now, I don't think the law was meant for private individuals to subsidize other private individuals. Clearly, I did not do this as an eleemosynary endeavor, and I don't want to evict or hurt anyone, but at some point in time, I'm getting hurt, as are thousands of small, much less fortunate people who own little apartments, six apartments in Staten Island or Queens or whatever it might be.
Right. Now, let's stay there, Marvin. Stay there. Let's see what Professor Shearer has to say.
I'm sorry. When you asked the second question,
If you're losing your train of thought, Marvin talks about taking a loss on apartments because of taxes. My understanding of how the Rent Guidelines Board works is that they take into account the expenses that landlords would be expected to have and actually, at least on paper, guarantee them a profit.
The Rent Guidelines Board increases doesn't necessarily – hang on, Marvin. Doesn't necessarily guarantee an individual landlord a profit because that's an across-the-board determination by the Rent Guidelines Board. But what Marvin may not know and what isn't sort of commonly known about the rent regulation laws is that they have a provision where you can seek a rent increase based on landlord hardship. If you're able to show that, in fact, it's a losing proposition, then you can make an application for a special rent increase to the state, and you can seek a rent increase based on the hardship. And, in fact, you know, that provision in the law has always been in the law to save it from being declared a taking because if you, in fact, couldn't make a profit at all, either as applied or across the board, then the law would be vulnerable as against an argument.
So there's some advice, Marvin. Maybe you can apply for an individual hardship adjustment.
It's impossible to apply for a hardship if you earn significant amounts of money. And I think
let him finish. Sure. Marvin, go ahead.
Yeah, just as your guest said to you in the very beginning of this, the dollar income of the resident is meaningless relative to the constitutional argument. The dollar income of the landlord should be irrelevant relative to the fairness of the argument.
No, you're right. It's not.
And let me say one thing. Let me just say one thing, sir. I have some of the finest legal talent in the city of New York. I won't mention their names, but the finest, and it cost an awful lot of money. They're all in disagreement with what you said. There is not an effective method by which small landlords or landlords such as myself can effectively receive just what it's costing them. I'm not talking about profit, sir. I'm talking about equal dollar for equal dollar.
Well, let me say that I agree with you that it's not relevant how much money you earn in general with respect to your eligibility for a hardship increase. The law allows you to apply for a hardship if the enterprise of that particular rental housing is not making a profit. That's the basis on which you can seek the increase. They don't look at your overall household income. They look at whether or not you're making a profit on that particular rental unit.
Marvin, thank you for your call. I appreciate you speaking up, and good luck with your situation. We'll take one more here, and I think it's a very good question. Just so people know the basics of why we're even having these conversations, and it comes from Jason peering across the Hudson River, maybe smirking from somewhere on the Garden State Parkway. Hi, Jason.
How you doing, Brian? I hope you can hear me. I'm on a Bluetooth in my car.
We got you fine.
All right, my question was, I used to live in New York City a long time ago, and I was never lucky enough to live in a rent-controlled or rent-stabilized apartment, but my understanding is that there's a difference between those two terms, that there's actually rent-stabilized apartments and rent-controlled apartments, and there's a difference in the law and the regulations and how they're how they're controlled by the city.
Right. So let's go over it very briefly,
sure.
And then we're going to be out of time.
So without a lengthy discourse on this, there are two systems of rent regulation. The older system is rent control. You can't move into a rent control apartment. You have to have lived there since 1971, since before June of 1971. The rent stabilization law came into effect.
And they are really cheap, the rent control
apartments. They tend to be really cheap. They also tend to be very low-income elderly people.
That's
because
right.
That's who remains.
Isn't that what Ed Koch had when he was mayor and he refused to give it up?
I believe that's right. There's only about 38,000
units. Like a $300 a month apartment in the village?
Yeah. And there's only about 38,000 of those left. There's over 1 million rent stabilized apartments, and that's the system that came into play starting in 69, but greatly expanded in 74 to cover the units that were being deregulated based on vacancy that had been rent control, and to cover all units with six apartments or more that were constructed before 1974.
Most places don't have this, including other crowded cities.
Right.
Is the bottom line here political, that the tenants' lobby has more political clout in Albany than the landlords' lobby?
Well, let me say that the bottom line now is political, now that the Supreme Court has said that there's no constitutional issue at stake here, and it's thrust back
into the
political.
They didn't exactly say that. They didn't rule that there is no constitutional issue. They just refused to hear the case.
They refused to hear the case, but the Second Circuit, the court directly below the Supreme Court, had ruled that the rent regulation, the rent stabilization system was constitutional. So by failing to take the case, that is the law.
In effect,
that
yeah.
is in effect the law, yes.
All right. And so we leave it there with Andrew Shearer, planning law professor at Columbia University and author of the book Residential Landlord-Tenant Law in New York. The news breaking this morning, the United States Supreme Court has declined to hear a constitutional challenge to the New York State rent regulations. So tenants, you can breathe a sigh of relief. And landlords, it is back to the political drawing board. Thank you very much, Professor Shearer. Thanks to all of you for all your calls. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, in a way, a related argument coming up next. And that is a debate for and against raising New York State's minimum wage and over mandating a living wage of $10 an hour for businesses getting big city subsidies. We'll hear both sides coming up in a minute.